Good morning. I'm Eva Lee Moore from New Orleans, Louisiana, and it is good to be in the house of the Lord. So anyway, this is unexpected, but I thank God for the opportunity. So I haven't been to camp since 1997 because life sets in. I lived in New York for 15 years. I grew up in New Orleans and grew up a Catholic and became born again in New York, an unlikely place. A place that my parents did not want me to move to after college, but I was a model and I wanted to go to the city and become rich and famous. And so I got to New York, but the Lord had other plans. I got saved in New York and got married and had three sons. But over the course of the 15 years that I lived in New York, there got to be a period of time when the Lord began to speak to my heart that it was time to go home. And I said, never. I will never move back down south to New Orleans. I love New York too much. A series of events. My ex-husband passed away, and a few things happened, and then it was like, whatever you want, Lord. I get the message. It's time to go. So being that my family was there and my kids, their dad's family was in Atlanta and Florida, I knew I'd be close to relatives and friends. So I did. So in August 1993, I packed up my bags and I moved home to New Orleans. I've been coming to camp since about 1989, when a woman by the name of Blanche Negron worked with me in a nursery at the Brooklyn Tabernacle and told us about Pilgrim Camp. And so myself and my friend Avril and Dorothy, we all started making the trek up to bring our kids, well, my kids and Bertie's kids. And friends would say, you're crazy, you used to drop the kids off and let them stay at camp and have a good time, but I signed up to work. So whenever my kids came to camp, I worked at camp, and I worked with Sister Antia. So I was a counselor in the cottages for several summers. And then when we moved to New Orleans, we got on Amtrak train and we came back up to camp. And Brother Paul would send somebody to pick us up when we get into Chestertown off of Amtrak and the bus that we took up here. And we continued that through 1997. And then by 1997, my boys got older and they were in high school and playing on the football team, and life kicked in and we couldn't get back. And so here it is today, 2011, and I'm just returning to camp. But I can tell you that over those years, that my heart pant for camp like a deer pants for water. I always felt like I gotta get back. I gotta get back to camp. And so this summer, I purposed in my heart that I was coming no matter what. And so praise the Lord, here we are. So when I moved to New Orleans, Louisiana in 93, I felt like I had lost the fellowship that I knew in New York. And my sons would go to school and they'd come home and they'd say, Mom, everybody down here professes to be a Christian, but nobody serves the Lord. And I told that to my pastor and he said, now that's profound for your son to be able to pick that up. Mm-hmm. But the Southern, well, I can't say Southern, whatever, but anyway, but the kids there were not like the kids that they had met in Pilgrim Camp and at Sunday school. And that really, I think, just really discouraged them that not everybody who said they were a Christian were Christian. And I think it also weakened their walk with the Lord. So over the course of the years, my oldest son rebelled for a period of time. And he was angry with the Lord because his father died and we were believing for his salvation and return to the Lord. And during that rebellion, he did some really terrible things. But what I did was I bought a ticket, we got on the train, and we came to camp. And I brought him up to camp. And we would be in these meetings at night, and everybody was crying out for Michael, crying out for Michael. And the Lord used that. And also at my old church in Brooklyn Tabernacle, they were crying out for Michael. And he got himself into some trouble. And he said when he was sitting there in the middle of this trouble and waiting for me to try to get him out, he said it just came to him. My mother didn't raise me this way. And when he found himself amongst boys that were heathens, he said, he looked at them and he goes, "That I'm not them. That's not me." And those things made him make a decision to come back to not fully serving the Lord, but it definitely took him from a way that could have led him to a life of crime. And so today that young man is a school teacher. He teaches sixth grade English, and he comes home and he tells me about his students. Mom, you wouldn't believe what they're doing. And I'm like, hello? Yeah. And so anyway, but to see the redemption of this life, I just have to give the Lord all the praise, all the honor, and all the glory. He could have been dead. He could have been in jail. But today he's a school teacher in sixth grade. And the end of this month, he'll be going to Oxford University in London. He kept speaking, I want to go to Europe. I want to go to Europe. So his your gifts will make room for you, young people. And he's so brilliant that even in his rebellion, in 10th grade, he took the PSAT test. And he was this rebellious youngster. No one knew how gifted he was. And the scores came back, and he was a National Achievement Scholar. So they came looking for him. They were like, who is this Michael Moore? Who is this Michael Moore? And so his gifts made room for him. He ended up with a 4-year scholarship to college. He paid not one thing. They paid him to come to college. And he graduated from Florida A&M, and that's how he ended up being a teacher today. But also, he's in grad school now to get a master's in education. He majored in business. And so again, someone had to write a paper to be able to travel to Europe with the professors to present a paper on the charter movement in New Orleans. And so he wrote a paper, and he sent it to me, and I gave him some feedback on it. He submitted it, and out of, I don't know how many students to write a paper, he was selected. So he will be going to Oxford University this summer to present along with the deans of education at his school. So once again, the Lord is continuing to pour into his life. My second son, John, is now going back to school to get a master's in rebuilding. So after Hurricane Katrina hit, he was in Atlanta, Georgia, and tried to convince his mother to leave town, and I would not. And so my younger son had just started law school at Tulane University, and I said, well, Robbie's in law school. I've just started my principalship. We're too busy. We can't leave town. And besides, these things are always just a farce, and you know, everybody gets on the road, and they end up coming right back. I'm not leaving. So sure enough, this was the big one. And there I was. I spoke from my mouth to my sister. I said, I'm not going to leave. You guys get Mom out of town, but I'm going to stay because I live in a two-story. And if anything happens, I'll sit on my roof. Sure enough, I was on my roof when the water came. And so from my mouth. But anyway, after Hurricane Katrina, I just remember being there in the house and falling on my knees the day, that Sunday before the storm, and talking to my cousin in Georgia and in Texas, and everybody under the sun was calling, Ava, get out, get out. But I had this incredible peace. I was like, I don't feel like I need to leave. And so talking to Birdie, to Avril, you know, she's like, well, if you stay, we're going to believe God with you. Her son, Adrian, wanted to kill us after that. He was like, you know, Mom, you should have counseled her to leave. But during that time, I fell on my knees, and I just cried out to the Lord. And I said, Lord, even in my folly, if I'm wrong, protect your handmaiden and her son. And when that water began to rise, the hurricane was totally over. There was peace. It was beautiful outside. But then my son said, Mom, the water is on the front lawn. And I said, no, that's unprecedented because this area never floods. We opened our door, and we could see a rush of water coming around the corner, like if the Mississippi River had just been let loose. And my heart sank, and I said, oh, God. And I said, you know, get your ID and put it on your person, like our governor had said to do before. And he says, what does that mean, Mom? What do you think? And I said, we're going to live, but we have to have our ID on us when they find us. And we began to run in the water, and it was rising rapidly. So I said, you know, our best bet is to go back home and to stay in the house, which we did, and we were there for about 2 days, and we were rescued. But during that time, we were on the roof of the house, and then we were living on the second floor of the house, but I would go outside on the roof, and we could hear people beating in their attics, and we didn't have to go in the attic because we had a two-story. So I would yell out to them, what house are you in? Give me your address, and so I'm writing this down. So when the boat came, I would lead them to different houses, and that I knew there were people there. And in this one house, this precious woman in her 80s didn't leave because she didn't want to leave her cat. And she came out with her purse on her arm, and the water was up to here. And we got her out and brought her to safety. And I remember getting to, this is an incredible thing, the incline from where my house is down a hill. Well, the main street is very high, it's built above sea level, but then when you go down into the subdivision of the homes, it goes down. So right maybe 5 blocks from my house was dry land, but we didn't know that. So when the boat got us there, I was amazed to find hundreds of other people who had also stayed behind. And when I got there, one woman was in the street crying, and she says, you've got to go back. I left my mother. She passed away, and she's in the house. And, you know, you should go back. And the police officer looked and said, ma'am, there's dead bodies all over the city. And that's when it hit me, and I was like, this is something that I've never seen. And the police officers began to say to us, you know, it's like martial law, every man for himself. And I just cried out to the Lord. And as people would come in boats, I'd say, where did you come from? Which neighborhood did you come from? And I would ask the addresses. And as I heard the addresses, I said, you mean my mother's house is gone? You mean my sister's house is gone? You mean my aunt's house is gone? And it began to hit me that every person in my family had lost everything that they ever owned. And people were eating, but I couldn't eat. I was just crying out. And the Lord used my son that night, also Robert, because he found a police station and brought them to where we were. And that morning they came in, they had guns pulled, and the Lord lifted me from my house and got us to dry land and took us to a bus company, a chartered bus company, where there were like 20 chartered buses, and that was the commodity at the time. So we went straight from there onto a bus that drove us safely out of town. And over that time, you know, friends were praying and all. And when I called my son John, he wept and he said, "Mom, I thought you had drowned. I thought you were dead." But the Lord just sort of raised the boys up at that time to really, in my eyes, become men. And I remember getting to Baton Rouge and going into this big coliseum where there were like an auditorium where people were in the big shelter. And my son looked at me and said, "Mom, you will not sleep here tonight. I don't know what I'm going to do, but you're not going to sleep here tonight." So he began to call friends of his that were in Baton Rouge at LSU school. They came to get us, and we stayed there that night. And that night, my son Robert got on the internet, and he began to blog, and he told the whole story of our rescue. And he said, "And every time I looked, Mom was asleep on the couch. She was asleep under the table on the floor." And people laughed, but it's so true. I slept through most of it, and Robert sort of took charge. We immediately got out of there, and there were other people that were stuck, and I saw some of my students, and they grabbed me and they were saying, "Did you see what happened? The eye of the storm came," and these little babies were crying and telling me what happened. And one grandmother said, "Leave Mrs. Moore alone, she's busy." And I said, "No," I said, "the children are going to need to talk after this. They're going to need to tell their stories." So I go over to my son's friend's apartment, and he's got this big tub, and I'm lying in the tub and relaxing. And then I began to weep, and I said, "Lord, I've made it out, and now I'm comfortable, but those other people, they're still there. There's thousands of them. What's going to happen?" And I cried, and I cried, and I said, "What should I do?" And I felt the Lord speak to my heart, and he said, "You're going to go back. You're going to go back to the city, and you will help to rebuild the education system, and you will bring those children home." So I had my charge from day one, and I moved to Georgia, and I stayed with Avril's son there, Adrian, for 3 months. And I never missed one paycheck. My school, charter school system, all the money you mentioned, Pastor Paul, I don't know how they were able to get it, but they contacted us immediately and said, "We will reopen, and we will reopen in January." And I came back to the city in October, pushed the door open to my house, and the feeling to just see everything you've ever owned just crumpled in, you know, pictures, everything, like your history just wiped away. The good thing is that on my second story of the house, we were able to bring some things upstairs since we were there. But I did come back, and in January 2000, the other good part of the story is that my son Robert, who stayed with me when we were in Georgia, he got an email from Tulane Law School saying that there's a gentleman in Hawaii who wants to help out. And so he wants all of the first-year law students to come to Hawaii, and he's going to get them internships with the firm. So when he got to Hawaii, they interviewed him on the news, and they said, "How did you go from Hurricane Katrina to paradise? How did you end up in Hawaii?" And he was there for 3 months and made very good money as an intern in law school. And he came back and finished law school. But anyway, we came back that January, and I looked at the house, and my heart was just broken, and the Lord led me to buy a new home. And so my insurance money was, you know, very good. I sold that property and bought a new house on the other side of the river, Mississippi River, that didn't flood in that area. And so we moved back, and by January 2006, we were right back to work. I was working at my school, my son was in law school, and my other son, John, who was living in Georgia at the time, went to a conference, and at this conference he met someone. He was in Green Building in Georgia, and the guy said, "We're ready to open a Global Green office in New Orleans, and we know that you're from there. Would you come to New Orleans with us and open this office?" And my son took the job, and when he came back, he was with the organization that built all the greenhouses in New Orleans, the whole Brad Pitt project. And so Brad Pitt funded their organization, and they were able to build many, many homes and bring people home. So the Lord has been faithful. Today, when I came back, I was an assistant principal, but today I'm a principal of a charter school with 500 students, kindergarten through eighth grade, and it does all the things that that Brother Paul talked about, creates a small learning community. And it's not without fault, and it's not without challenges. What's happened in New Orleans is that We have basically, and I say we, but it's, you know, the school system has turned nearly every school in New Orleans into a charter school. We only have maybe five schools left that are not charter schools in the city of New Orleans. And it's both good and bad. It's got its advantages and its disadvantages, but for the most part, I'm seeing the advantages. When you guys were talking about your teachers last night, it really touched my heart because my school is not a Christian school, and I don't have many teachers on the staff that I could say would be able to give you godly counsel. But I know that the Lord uses me often, not just with the students, but with the teachers. I find that I'm the counselor for the teachers, and so many of them come to me and they'll walk away and say, man, you know, thank you so much. You helped me to get a perspective on things. I never mention the word God. I never mention the Lord, but it's the wisdom of the Lord that I can use to steer some of them in the right direction. And I guess one of the best compliments I got was from a kindergartner who said to me, you make me feel ticklish inside. And so I says, that's the joy of the Lord, you know. So so I know that the Lord is using me there. And so I just want to encourage you young people today that I remember crying out to the Lord when I lived in New York, and I said, why was I born? I don't know what I should do. Because remember, I wanted to be a rich and famous model. Mm-hmm. I never wanted to be a teacher. And so in my journal, I remember after I had my three sons and I wasn't modeling anymore, and I said, Lord, lead me and show me what you want me to be, but let it be anything except a teacher. And sure enough, it was one of the most practical things to do at the time. I started substitute teaching so that I could be available to my kids. And the principal said, you're a natural. You are a natural. You should definitely become a teacher. And so one thing led to another. I ended up taking over somebody's class, going to Brooklyn College and getting a master's in education. So you can major in business and still become a teacher. And my business background, I think, is what really began to encourage, have people to encourage me to become a principal because of my business acumen. So between the business degree and the master's in education, put them together, and it's made me out to be a pretty okay principal, I feel. So just want to encourage you guys to open your hearts to the Lord and ask the Lord what he would have you to do. It may be a career change here and there. It's not always the first thing that you do is going to be everything. So I saw Sister Antia my first day back, and I was so excited to see her, and I went up to her, and you know, she was so happy. And she's someone who said to me when I moved to New Orleans, she says, now you're moving away. Don't fall away from the Lord because you weren't near the close fellowship, and come back to camp. And over the years, she's been so faithful to send letters and cards and notes to my sons over the years. So when I went to her, and she was so happy to see me, and she said, and how are the boys? And I said, well, Robbie's an assistant district attorney, and Mike's a teacher, and John's in college getting his master's in green building. She says, but are they serving the Lord? But are they serving the Lord? And I said, I can give a check next to Robbie's name. Keep praying for Mike and John. And so, but in the end, only what you do for the Lord will last. And so no matter what your degree, no matter what your profession, what you do for the Lord is what will last. And so I want to encourage you guys this morning with that to open your hearts this week to the Lord. That week when I brought my son back and he was in a state of rebellion, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was the prayers of camp and the peace and the purity of camp. I come back because of the holiness and the purity of camp, and it's my barometer. I come back and I do a check on myself, and I tell you, the first night here, I sat by the lake and I just wept. It was like my soul was saying, welcome home. And so now Avril's grandkids come to camp, and someday when I have grandkids, we're going to take that Amtrak trip and we're coming back to camp. So thank you for the opportunity to share this morning, Brother Paul.
Thank you.